Love Your Work is supported in part by Treehouse. Take your career to the next level and learn from over 1,000 videos created by expert teachers on web design, coding, business, and much more. Claim your 14-day free trial at cadavy.net/treehouse. You'll be supporting the show. This is Love Your Work. On this show, we meet people who have carved out success by their own definition. If you are sick of all the posturing going on in entrepreneurship today, this is the show for you. We are not crushing it. We aren't trying to optimize every last bit of joy out of our work. Actually, I think Jason Fried said it well. Here's Jason in episode one.
I've never ever been someone who's been interested in squeezing the last dime or penny out of anything. Like, I don't find that to be interesting at all. Like, I don't find extreme optimization to be interesting. Like, how can we move the numbers by 0.5%? Because there's money out there that we're not, you know, like, that doesn't do it for me.
Yes, on Love Your Work, we just have real people with real stories, philosophies, and tactics for finding work in your love and love in your work. Besides Jason Fried, we also have Paul Bennett, who sailed around the world while running his business. He's on episode 15. And we have Laura Roeder, who explains how the same decisiveness that got her honored at the White House carries over into choosing a bathroom faucet at Home Depot. Laura's on episode 9. We also have experts like John Cunyos, a neuroscientist who studies aha moments. He tells you about how to create the scientifically proven conditions for insight in episode 8. I'm David Cadavy, and I've spent the past 12 years finding love in my work, digging deeper every day. My first book, Design for Hackers, was a bestseller in the top 20 on all of Amazon. Every Thursday, I love bringing you a new guest or hard-earned wisdom of my own to help you find love in your work and define success for yourself. I think the show is pretty good, but let's see what Jason Fried thinks.
I think your show has a lot of legs because you're a really good interviewer and you have really good deep questions and original questions. So I'm really excited to hear all your future interviews.
So tap the subscribe button in iTunes and join us as we dig into the questions we all run into in defining success. Where do you make compromises? How do you know when it's time to leave money on the table? And how do you turn your biggest challenges into your biggest opportunities? And if you agree with Jason, please write us a review. It really helps. Our guest today wrote the blueprint for finding love in your work. Jeff Goins is the author of The Art of Work, a proven path to discovering what you were meant to do. In The Art of Work, Jeff explains why finding your calling doesn't always follow the neat storybook path that you expected. You have to listen to your life, engage in painful practice, and build bridges, all to let your story emerge. In this discussion, we talk about how clarity comes with action, what makes practice deliberate practice, and why frequency matters more than quantity. We'll also share the most cringe-inducing story of asking someone out that I think that I've ever heard. And don't worry, there's a lesson to be learned from it. Be sure to check out Jeff's book, The Art of Work. If you buy it through cadavy.net/artofwork, then you will be supporting the show. Here's the interview. Love Your Work is supported in part by Audible. Choose from over 180,000 audiobooks on any subject that you can imagine. You can try Audible for free at cadavy.net/audible. Start off with Getting Things Done. It will help you take control of your time and manage all the inputs in your life. Go to cadavy.net/audible and claim your free audiobook. I'm here with Jeff Goins, the author of The Art of Work. And Jeff, I checked this book out and it's like the perfect blueprint of how to kind of find your calling. What was it that motivated you to write this book?
Yeah, so a friend of mine named Mark, really when I was deciding whether or not I should quit my job, which I actually enjoyed, you know, a lot of people talk about being stuck in a cubicle and having to get out of there. And I actually think if that's your situation, like that's a good place to be. Because you absolutely know something has to happen. But one of the most dangerous places to be in life is comfortable, secure. And that's kind of where I was. And so, you know, a bunch of crazy things happened where I was able to replace my wife's income, my income, and then we tripled our income, you know, starting this business. But all of that happened while I still had a job. And I was talking to my friend Mark about this, and I was like, I don't know what to do. I worked for this nonprofit. We were doing meaningful work. You know, I wasn't like working for a soulless corporation or something. And he said this to me. He said, "What's happened to you is rare, and you need to consider the possibility that this might be your calling. And that if you don't do this, this is like disobeying your calling." And I was like, "Oh, well, that sounds heavy." And so I did it. I quit my job, actually went to my boss, and I told him, "Hey, if you don't want me to do this, I won't do it." And he goes, "No, I think you should do it." He goes, "I'm proud of you, and I've been waiting for this conversation. I knew it was going to happen." So like all these things had sort of aligned to, you know, get me to this place, you know, that's now my career as a professional writer. And, you know, like you have dinner parties or whatever, you hang out with people and they go, "How did you do that?" And I used to explain it like, "Well, I decided I want to be a writer, and then I did it, and I tried to make smart decisions, and, you know, then I had some measure of success." And I realized that everything about that story is a lie. And I think that the way most people describe their success trajectories sounds something like that. "I always wanted to do this. I decided to do it," you know, in some sort of flash of insight or epiphany. "Then I did it, and there was failure, but ultimately I triumphed all on my own, and aren't I awesome?" And everything about those stories for most of my life has depressed me. It's made me go, "Well, that must be nice, right?" Because most people I talk to have no idea what they want to do with their life. Or if they know what they want to do, it seems so far out of reach that they don't know how they're going to take the first step. So I wanted to write a book for the rest of us about what does it mean to discover your dream, find your calling, do work that matters in a way that like fits with the rest of life. And so I wrote this book that sort of felt like a Tony Robbins kind of rah-rah, you know, fest. And I didn't like it that much, nothing against Tony, but it was like, "You can do this, you're amazing." And I was like, this isn't what the process felt like when I went through it. I was scared and, you know, completely unconfident and insecure and afraid at every moment it was all going to fall apart. And I just like, I wanted to read a book like that. Like, "Hey, you're scared? Good. Like that means you're going in the right direction. Hey, you think you're a piece of crap and don't know what's going on? Good news. You're on the path, you know?" And I just wanted a messier description of the process. So I went out and I interviewed all these people who were not celebrities but had found their callings, were doing interesting, meaningful work in the world, supporting themselves through it. And I asked them some questions, and then I started to find some themes that were true for them. And I was like, "Oh yeah," it was illuminating my own journey. And I realized the things that I were saying were like half true. I didn't know what I wanted to do, but it was always this theme. Writing was always this constant theme in my life. I just kind of failed to acknowledge it until I started doing this thing Parker Palmer calls listening to your life. And so there are all these half-truths that I think we'd say about success and purpose. And the book, I feel like, you know, sort of illuminates the whole truth of it, or at least I tried to do that. And I did that through my own story, case studies, and, you know, some research.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, a lot of times you hear success stories from people and it's sort of like hindsight is 20/20. They're sort of saying, "Oh, I decided to do this," when in fact they kind of did this because they were possibly reacting in some emotional way and they weren't quite sure why they were doing what they were doing. And then they end up doing it and things work out. And then you can look at it in retrospect and it all just makes this nice story.
Right.
So you were looking for something a little messier.
Yeah. And I forget what they call that. Maybe like the narrative fallacy or something. Mm-hmm. But it's when you look back on your life and you go, "Oh, this thing happened and this thing happened and this thing happened." And they all kind of line up and you've got to do these things in this order. When in reality, when you're in the midst of that story, when any character is in the midst of a story, they have no idea what's going on, right? Like we can watch it from the comfort of our, you know, seats and go, "Oh, this is really interesting. Like, isn't conflict fun? Because we don't know what's going to happen next." But when you're a character in that story, it's scary, right? You're going, "I don't know what's going to happen." And it either feels really boring or really stressful. And so what would it be like to not tell the story on the other end, but tell the story as it's happening, right? So what does it mean about like, you know, when you've had failure after failure after failure and you feel like you just can't get it right and you read another self-help book that says, "Just do it, man. You know, like you're going, no, I tried this. It didn't work. Well, you know, one of the things I found was failure actually gets you to success, you know, and everybody I talked to did not just have one failure, but often multiple devastating failures, and the failures taught them things. And it wasn't like if you don't, you know, if you fail it for, if you don't first succeed, try again. What is it? W.C. Field says, if you don't at first succeed, you know, then quit, you know, don't be a damn fool about it. Like, go do something else. And that was one of the things that I learned in the book was failure is an opportunity to pivot. It's an opportunity to change the direction a little bit. I just think this story that, like, you pick a dream, you plow down, you know, and go for it, and you're guaranteed success. That's not true. And that's not what most successful people do. From the people I talk to Steve Jobs, to Walt Disney, to Mother Teresa, they all were, as you said, responding to what life was throwing at them. And one of the things I learned from this project, and I put this in the book, is what makes a life extraordinary aren't the chances we get, but what we do with them. And we're all looking at our lives, most of us, going, I wish there was more to this. You know, like, we look at somebody else's life and we go, huh, must be nice. You know, like, must be nice to, you know, have gone to Yale, you know, at the same time Tim Ferriss did, and have all these great connections in Silicon Valley. Like, must be nice to be an outlier or whatever. Like, I think most of us are looking at our lives going, this is it. You know, and what I learned from talking to all these people who are living these extraordinary lives is they didn't have that mindset. They took whatever life threw at them and they said, yeah, this is it, and I'm going to do something extraordinary with it.
So I found it funny that your boss seemed to just, when you were telling that story, your boss seemed to want you to go ahead and do this, and that your yeah. boss was sort of waiting for this thing to happen. It were there some clues going on that maybe you missed that other people saw, that you needed to move on and try something else, try being a writer?
Yeah, I think so. I think that sometimes we are the last people to acknowledge what's in us, you know, what that stirring, that calling, that dream is. I went to a conference years before I had that conversation with my boss, and it was like a conference about finding your dream job, right? And at that conference, they encouraged you to, like, write down the first word that came to your mind when you thought about what you wanted to do with your life. And for whatever reason, that day I wrote down writer. And I was like, wow, I guess I'm supposed to be a writer. And there were several moments like this where I was like, what? Like, I kept fighting it. I was afraid of it. I was afraid of what it would require of me. So I run home and I tell my wife, and I have this, you know, notebook, and I go, look at this. Look what this says. It says writer. I'm supposed to be a writer. It's amazing. She goes, well, duh. What do you think I've been telling you all these years? And so I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, you know, and a little while after that, I was talking to a friend. He asked me what my dream was. I was still hesitant to admit it because I didn't want to be wrong. Because when you, like, say it out loud, and I don't know about you, but I was surrounded by all my friends who were a little bit flaky, and, like, they're like, oh, my dream is to go be, you know, an astronaut or a scuba diver. Like, every week was a different dream. You know, I had these really passionate, creative friends. And I was like, look, I cannot keep up with these guys. Like, one week it's, I'm going to go do this. They go do it for 6 months. And then they come back and they're, like, working at Starbucks or something. And so I just didn't want to be that. I was afraid of looking like a failure, I guess. It was ego. And so I wouldn't admit it. And so this guy asked me what my dream was. And I said, I don't know. And he just met me. But he knew I had a blog. He knew I'd been writing for a while. I was a marketing director at this nonprofit. So a lot of what I did was communication for a living. And he said, huh. He said, that's interesting that you say you don't have a dream. Because I would have just thought that you would have said that you wanted to be a writer. But if you say that you don't have a dream, well, like, okay, I get it. You know, I was like, wait, hang on. Yeah, okay. I guess I'd like to be a writer someday. And he looked at me. And he said, Jeff, you don't have to want to be a writer. You are a writer. You just need to write. And that was an important moment for me. I know that, you know, we're supposed to say you don't need anybody's permission. You can go out and do what you want to do. But I think that it's really hard to succeed in life without guides, without community. I think every story of success is really a story of community. And the truth is that we always have people in our lives who are affirming who we really are. We just need to listen. So these were voices in my life saying, this is who you are. Are you going to be this? Or are you going to keep trying to be somebody else? And so I was like, well, I guess I'll give this a try. Like, maybe activity follows identity. Maybe I have to start thinking like this person, and then I'll act like it, and then I'll become that person. So the next day after he said, you are a writer, you just need to write, I was like, okay, I'm a writer. And when people asked me what I did, I was like, I'm a writer. And then they like asked me that next awkward question, like, well, what do you write? I was like, hang on, I got to go do something. I'll be right back. You know, I got to go write something. And I was like, okay, I'm putting myself out there. I'm going to have to do it. And so the next day at 5 a.m., I woke up that morning before I got ready for work or anything, and I wrote. And I wrote about 500 words. And day after that, I did it again, and I did it again. I did it every day for a year. I put a lot of this on a blog. I ended up building a community. About a year and a half into it, I got an offer from a book publisher. Shortly after that, I started this online business. And by the end of that second year, I was having that conversation with my boss, and he had seen all this happen. And like my friend Mark, he said, this is rare the way all this stuff happens, and it happens so quickly. And my boss saw that too, and he knew it was coming, and he was a mentor of mine. He was very affirming. I'm not saying that every boss is going to be like, hey, you should do this, or that you even need to quit your job. But I think there were lots of people in my life who were going, finally, Jeff is becoming this person that for a long time we knew he was.
And so you feel like it was a gradual process for you coming to this realization? I mean, it sounds like you were reluctant to say that you were a writer, to make this statement about what you wanted to be, because in doing so, you would have to make this commitment. You'd sort of be on the hook, and that would be kind of uncomfortable. And so to protect your own ego in a way, you might have just been afraid to say those words. But once you started saying those words, then there was this consistency thing that you were trying to keep up where, well, I said this, I'm going to experience cognitive dissonance if I don't.
That's right.
If I don't go ahead and do it. So is that kind of how that worked?
It was gradual, and I was scared to say it. And then when I started saying it, I was like, oh, crap, I have to do this now. And maybe some people can do this. They can say one thing and act differently. And we've all got a little bit of that in ourselves, but I've never been okay with that. So if I was going to walk around and say, I'm a writer, I was going to have to do it. I was going to have to really own it. And for me, you know, it was an important part of the process. Like I said, I believe that activity follows identity. A lot of people talk about faking it till you make it. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think you do have to believe it till you become it. And there is a certain act of faith here, right? I'm stepping out saying, I'm a writer. Well, what have you written? Well, not much. But until I start putting myself into this position where I am required to do the work, I will not do it. Like when you get hired to do a job, even if you're qualified for the job, you're still going to have to grow into that position. You don't show up usually on day one knowing everything that you're going to need to do the way that it needs to be done in that particular company, at that particular culture. The same thing is true with your calling, with your dream, except there's nobody, there's no HR manual that's going to say, here's what you need to do on day 37. So I think that we have to sort of put on this bigger coat that we grow into over time.
Yeah, you can't really, go down to the high school guidance counselor and say, yeah, give me the packet on how to become a professional basketball player or a famous artist or a famous writer. And then, they just go, oh, well, here's the steps. You just follow these. And it doesn't really work that way, does it?
No, I really think it is it's a discovery process, and everybody wants clarity. Everybody wants to know what to do before they act. I call that the you just know illusion. It's a myth. I think for most of us, clarity comes with action. So you take a small step, and then you go, oh, I see a little bit further down this path. You take another small step, you see a little bit further. But you have to take those steps. And for me, the first step was saying, I'm a writer, and then I have to start acting like it.
Do you remember that first day when you sat and wrote 500 words or so? Do you remember what you wrote about that day?
I don't remember. Oh, okay. That's a great question. I mean, I should have it on the wall, right? But, I think maybe there's something telling about that. Your first step may not be that memorable. It may not be an epiphany, and that's okay. It could be a very clumsy first step, but the point is to start building some momentum over time.
I think there can actually, if you were able to find that stuff, you'd probably be surprised how prescient it might be. On my blog, the very first blog post is me basically saying, I'm not really quite sure why I'm doing this, but I think I might write some stuff about design. I eventually wrote a book about design. Sometimes I have a tendency to think about stuff too much and it paralyzes me. And it's all one run-on paragraph. It's got a misspelling in it. It is a terrible piece of work, but I can look at it and say, wow, actually, there were some things that I knew that I didn't even know that I knew at that point. Yeah. You find clues like that in what you've looked at?
Yeah, I love going back to the first few blog posts because that year I started writing maybe that October, and by January I'd started my blog, and that's where I started putting all of my daily writing. And I did it for a year. I wrote 365, actually wrote about 400 articles that year.
Wow.
So more than a post per day. And you know, like, I feel, and maybe you feel this way too, I feel like my voice, my style, my skill, I feel like I'm always me. I always feel like I've always felt, if that makes sense. And then when you look back 10 years or a few years or 900 blog posts ago, and you go, no, I sucked.
You know? It's like looking at that weird hairstyle you had in your junior high, or what I'm going to look at when I look back on myself 10 years from now.
I mean, so I remember trying to be really clever with one of my first blog posts. I was like trying to be Seth Godin, and I was like writing these like vague, you know, blog post titles that made you like think differently. Mm-hmm. And I remember the first title was, I wanted to write this like self-helpy, like you don't have to play with the hand, you know, life deals you can kind of choose your own destiny or whatever. And so I was messing with the phrase, when life hands you lemons, make lemonade. And I was like, you don't have to do that. You can do whatever you want. You can make orange juice, you know? And so
you can't make orange juice out of lemons.
And so my title was like, when life hands you lemons, learn alchemy. And that was my like really clever, like, and like in the post somewhere, I was like, you can make, you know, orange juice out of lemons, you know, and like the idea was like, you can just turn the lemons into oranges. I don't know what I was smoking.
I know exactly what you're talking about, because I still to this day write things that are obtuse and abstract, and I'll read them like the next day and say, why did I ever think that was going to make any sense to anybody? But it's part of the process. You know, you get better over time. One thing I've done is, it sounded like you had a habit of writing. I've actually been against that in the past.
Yeah.
You know, I've been more into, I need to write, like, spend a month on a post and really put it out. And I put out good stuff that way. But just in the month of April, I've been writing and publishing a 500-word Medium article every day.
Cool.
And I've been surprised that there's actually some benefits to that. What have you found that's been good about having a habit of writing?
Yeah. You definitely – I just found that over time, frequency mattered more than quantity, meaning it was better for me to write a little bit every day than to do what I was doing before, which was basically binge writing. So once every 3 weeks on a random Saturday, I'd grab my laptop, I'd go outside and sit on her porch, and I'd write for like 3 hours on the afternoon. Mm-hmm. And I thought I was like creating like genius. I was writing these essays. I thought it was amazing. And then I went back and read them later, and I was like, these are not good. They're not polished. They're just sort of, you know, it's binging and purging, you know, where I was writing a bunch, then not writing at all. And when I just started writing a little bit, 500 words a day, over the course of a year, I got much, much better. I got better as a writer. I mean, this is pretty, I mean, qualitatively, you can just see it. I got better in a year writing every day than I did the previous 7 or 8 years writing whenever I felt like it.
Yeah. And I found that when you decide that you're going to do it every day, it makes it way easier to write instead of deciding not to write. Kind of like, even as I approach the keyboard, I'm like, oh my God, I've got to write this. This post, this is miserable. And then I get there, and as soon as I get into it, I'm ready to go. And it would have been so easy for me to just decide to do something else if I hadn't made the commitment already.
And when you have a daily deadline, you just have to get better faster.
Yeah, and I've been doing it in the mornings, and I try to get it done within an hour and a half or so. And the 500 word limit has been a big surprise too, because I didn't realize how long winded I can be in writing until I was like, oh, I've got to make this 500 words. You know, like one, I want to branch off and like, yeah, I'm talking about this concept, but I'm also talking about this. Like, no, it's only about this one concept. You just have to like be strict with yourself that way too when you have it. So having those constraints definitely inspires action.
Absolutely. Yeah. Love that.
So you said that you were writing for, it sounded like a couple of months or so before you finally wrote on that blog. What do you think was, why weren't you publishing on the blog at that time?
Because I still thought writing was private. You know, I think I was occasionally publishing something on the blog. And then in that January, I launched the blog and got like a little, you know, logo and went pro. I was like, this is a thing now. Got a self-hosted blog and like took it a lot more seriously and thought, I'm going to do something with this. So before that, I just felt like writing was private. I was just kind of writing these little files and saving them on my computer. And what I realized, I'm a musician. And after I graduated from college, I toured the country playing music for a year touring the U.S. And as a musician, my whole life, my dad taught me guitar when I was 16. And so, you know, 6 years later, I'm 22, traveling the country playing music. And I had these limiting beliefs that I told myself, like, you're never going to be good as blank, you know, Jimi Hendrix or something. You'll never be able to play this song because it's so hard, right? And I was like, I'm just a rhythm guitar player and I just, you know, I play okay, you know, and that's fine. And I was very happy with that. Well, then when I joined this band and we played a show almost every day, sometimes we played five shows in a day, just like the same set, you know, back to back to back to back. And by the end of that year, I was playing guitar better than I had ever played it. And I was playing solos and lead guitar and doing stuff that I never thought I could possibly do. I don't know if I was as good as Jimi Hendrix. I doubt I was. But the point was I realized what practice made possible. And it wasn't just practice, because I'd been practicing guitar for 6 years. I realized the difference was practicing in private versus practicing in public. Having a show to play every day made rehearsals way more real. So when we rehearsed, you know, back in my basement when I was playing this with this band in high school, we called Decaf because we didn't have a drummer. We had three guitars and no drummers. We're like Decaf, we're like decaffeinated music, no percussion. We thought that was clever. And so when we were practicing then, you know, for like the show we had once a quarter or whatever, we were like, oh, stop, hang on, I messed up. Let's go back and fix that. When we were rehearsing that afternoon, when I was traveling with the band, we were rehearsing for the show that night. You screwed up. You kept going because that's what was going to happen that night. And you just realized how to bring your A game. And I decided, well, why am I not doing that with writing? I need to be practicing in public. And that's when I started publishing a blog post every day.
Cool. And so do you have any more insight into what you think might have been holding you back from actually going ahead and taking that leap and doing that practicing in public?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, pick one, you know, a fear of failure, fear of people saying this sucks, you know, fear of criticism, all those things. And all those fears have come true. You know, people have said my writing sucks and I've put stuff out there that wasn't right or accurate or I wish I could take back. And all that stuff made me better. I think it was not acknowledging that failure is not the thing that prevents you from succeeding, right? Like, I just want to like spend 8 years in my basement getting really good at something and then come out and say, here's my thing, world. Like, look how awesome I am. Like, aren't I wise? Aren't I skilled? Aren't I amazing? People go, wow, he just came out of nowhere. Like, I would love for that to happen. That's not going to happen. What I've realized is most people who achieve greatness don't do that. They start out putting their work out into the world and go, hey, here's my thing. And people, you know, say, oh, this is crappy or this is great or, you know, here's what could be improved. And it's this iterative process over time.
We're going to take a quick break. I want to tell you about ActiveCampaign. If you don't have an email list for your business, you should have one. And if you build an email list, you should do it with ActiveCampaign. I've used other email service providers, but the moment I used ActiveCampaign, I was in love. They have this incredible visual drag-and-drop editor for designing automations. I can do super sophisticated automations, so I don't have to think about email marketing at all. You see, with my previous ESP, I could do automations, but they were really simplistic. With ActiveCampaign, I can create automations with if-then conditions. I can add tags to users based upon certain behavior, like let's say someone clicks on a link, and then I can trigger other automations. So for example, I have a free email course at designforhackers.com, and it starts every Monday. And I built an automation that encourages new students to share the course before the deadline to sign up each week, which happens on Friday. Now, this creates a viral loop that keeps new leads coming in my list. And it sounds really simple, but I couldn't do it with my old ESP. It was impossible. And with ActiveCampaign, it's a piece of cake. Best of all my automations are in a visual drag-and-drop editor, so I can actually see how people are moving through my automations. Before, I had so much trouble just picturing how my automations worked. I'd try to scribble out the diagrams, and then they'd invariably be wrong. But with ActiveCampaign, it's all right there in front of me. If I change the automation, I can see it visually. It just fits my brain. It's what you would call intuitive. If you have yet to start your email list, I encourage you to start with ActiveCampaign. And it can be tempting to go with the cheapest or the most popular option if you're just starting out, but you just create problems for yourself down the road. It took me months, actually it took me 3 months to switch everything over to ActiveCampaign. Now, it was well worth it, but I could have saved myself headaches if I would have just started with ActiveCampaign, if only I had known about it, like I'm telling you about it right now. Their prices are very competitive for smaller lists, but now that I have a larger list, ActiveCampaign is actually cheaper than my old ESP. I recognized early on that I would outgrow my old ESP, and I researched for years before I discovered ActiveCampaign. But as soon as I started playing with it, I knew it was the one. There is nothing I spend more money on in my business than email marketing, and there is no company whose service I love more than ActiveCampaign's. I'm serious. That's why I give them my highest recommendation. Go try out ActiveCampaign for free for 14 days at cadavy.net/ActiveCampaign. You don't even need a credit card. Claim your 14-day free trial at cadavy.net/ActiveCampaign. You'll be supporting the show.
I remember hearing this story about the musician Beck, about how, you know, Beck has this like psychedelic sort of sound to his music and very, you know, interesting folksy sound. He used to just walk into bars and say, "Hey, can I play for these people?" He'd pull out his acoustic guitar and he'd just start playing these like really like emo, non-bar kind of songs. And what it did was it made him really resilient. It made him go into the toughest crowd and be able to leave there sharing his art, not with people like having won over the crowd. There were a lot of crowds he didn't win over, but being able to leave that experience and go, "I survived." Bill Murray, I heard him once talk about what it's like to do stand-up comedy. He says, you're afraid that you're going to die when you're up there. And that's the best and worst feeling in the world. And so, you know, I think it's the fear, like it's the incredibly irrational fear, like this is going to kill me. And then you do it and you realize, this actually didn't kill me, so maybe I could do it again tomorrow.
I mean, the first couple times that somebody tells you that you suck, it's you know, it takes a toll on you. I don't know what it was for you, but you know, for myself, the first couple of times I heard that, it might have affected me. But now I've heard it so many times that it's like the boy who cried wolf or something like that. Not that you don't ever have like useful criticism that you get every once in a while, but you realize it's not all about you.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I have never gotten over that. It still hurts. You know, it still hurts when somebody says your book sucked, man, or this, you know, this blog post is wrong. You know, I go, "Huh, well, that hurts my feelings." You know, it hurts. It feels like it hurts about the same. I just realized that this doesn't stop me from getting up tomorrow and doing it again. And even with like the really harsh, terrible, awful things that people say, like I know people that can just dismiss all that. For me, good or bad, right or wrong, it all affects me. And I think over time, all of it makes me better.
Right. And you said that you launched, that you had like a logo and everything when you launched. Do you feel like, was that something that you were thinking about that held you back a little bit? That did you need the logo to launch? Could you have launched before that?
Yeah, great question. I actually launched without a logo.
Oh, okay.
And my friend who is a designer by the end of the day was like, dude, here, put a logo on that site.
Logo.
And he emailed me a logo. And I was like, oh, cool, thanks. Which again, that same friend that emailed me that logo, his name was Paul, was the same guy that 6 months before or whatever said, hey, you are a writer. You just need to write. So
like your spirit
again,
guide or something.
I know, he's my spirit animal, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the point is the thing that's in you that you're meant to do is obvious to the people who know and love you. It's not obvious to everybody. It doesn't mean that there aren't going to be people who stand in the way of your dream, but it does mean that there are people in your life who are going to root for you, who are going to cheer you on, who are going to hold you accountable. And when you start listening to that, I mean, you kind of form this community of people that can help you get to where you want to go. And again, I'm not just talking about my life. I'm talking about these hundreds of people I interviewed who had found their calling. And these, I geek out on biography. I've read all these biographies of famous and successful and interesting people. I can't find a story or a case study where someone succeeded at the thing that they were meant to do. And that's subjective, right? But they're going, yeah, like I feel pretty good about the work that I'm doing. I'm not just working for some faceless organization doing stuff that I don't believe in. And I can't find an example of somebody who got there on their own, who didn't have a community supporting them.
So when you were going out on your own, you sound like you had a lot of people who were really supportive. What about the naysayers? Were there folks who were, concerned for you and such and told you so?
Yeah. I mean, of course. Yeah. When you tell somebody you're going to be a writer, you tell your family. Friends, people go, oh, okay, good luck with that. I think we put a lot of pressure on this, on the big reveal, and it's unnecessary. One of the things that I learned through this research process of talking to all these people that I mentioned, I interviewed hundreds of people while writing this book, and I noticed that one of the things that we say in our culture that I just think is wrong is we talk about the leap, right? And I think
so the building bridges.
No, yeah, there is no leap. I'm thinking the Matrix. There is no spoon. And I talked to this one couple who started this coffee company in Burundi, the world's second poorest country. This white American family moved to South Africa, and then they moved to Burundi after that. And they started this coffee farm, working with these local farmers, trying to help them get fair wages for their work. And I asked the wife of the couple, Christy Carlson, how did this happen? How did you get here, right? And you guys were this nice American family, and now you're growing coffee in Africa. How'd that happen? And she said, well, we took a leap, and it was a wonderful leap. And I said, wow, that's amazing. How long, approximately, did that leap take? And she said, oh, it took 10 years. And I said, well, that's interesting. Like, that's a really slow motion leap. And to be fair, it does take faith to do that. It does take risk. So I'm not trying to belittle that at all. But we talk so much about that. Isn't it interesting that even when describing a 10-year process, she called it a leap? When really, I think it's more akin to, as you said, building a bridge over time, getting to where you want to go. So you're asking about the naysayers. There were some people who were naysayers, but the truth, David, is that by the time I got to the other side, by the time I said, hey, I'm going to be a writer, the bridge was already built, because what I had done was I had been writing on this blog for a year and a half. I launched not one book, but two books. And by the time I quit my job and told the world that I was a full-time writer, like I had already replaced and tripled my income.
You were already a writer by the time you you actually were taking, quote-unquote, the leap.
Right, yeah. And so, look, I mean, I think there are times when it makes sense to quit your job and have your Jerry Maguire moment where you, like, storm off and say, who's coming with me?
This is not the first interview where Jerry Maguire has come up, by the way.
Yeah, I think for most people, it's probably not going to work that way. You know, I had a family. I had people who were relying on me, and I just I didn't want to do like the leap where you fall on your face and have to get up and dust yourself off. Because the other side of that story, we love fetishizing risk and failure without realizing there's a cost to that, and sometimes it's an unnecessary cost. I asked a girl out one time in college, and a couple of friends of mine goaded me into going big or going home, right? So they're like, how are you going to ask this girl out? I was going to ask her to the dance. I was a sophomore and she was a senior, and she was my freshman orientation leader, which means that like her job was for like a week the first year of college to say like, here's the cafeteria, here's the library, see you later. And of course I read into that and said, oh, she's into me. Sweet. Being the gentleman that I was and having nothing to do with the fact that I was petrified of girls, I waited an entire year before working up the courage to ask her out, at which point I make the mistake of telling my friends that I'm going to ask her out. And they go, how are you going to do it? I said, well, I'm going to call her. And they go, dude, you have to go big or go home. So I did the thing that I think any self-respecting college male with a acoustic guitar in the corner of his room, which is, you know, every college male, you know, acoustic guitar in the corner of my room would do. I wrote her a song and I called her one Saturday afternoon. She answered. I hung up because then I knew that she was home, and I raced across campus, which wasn't a very big campus, with my guitar on my back. I knocked on her door. She opened the door. And I stepped into this room full of people, and they all looked at me. She had a little party. You know, she was the hall director. Yeah, she was the hall director of her dorm. And so she had a larger suite, and she had probably half a dozen, you know, six, eight people in her room, and they're all just hanging out. And they're all looking at me. She has no idea what's going on. I'm looking at them, and I'm going, oh, God, like, am I ever going to work up the courage to do this again? You know, so either I do this and risk failure in front of an audience, or I, you know, tuck tail and head home. And so I'm standing at the threshold and I take a bold step into her room and I just start playing the guitar, play this 90-second love song that through the process I ask her to the dance, tell her how it's going to go, you know, and why it's going to be the best date of her life. And then I strum that final C chord and I look at her and she looks at me and everybody looks at her and we just wait and there's this moment of silence. And then she says, I can't. And then she starts telling me these excuses about why she can't go to the dance. And I had done a little bit of intel beforehand and asked a friend of a friend, because he knew her, if like if I should ask her out, if she would, you know, if she'd say yes. And I think he knew that she wasn't into me, but he didn't know how to break it to me. He goes, let me put it this way. And her name was Lane. If Lane wants to go to the dance with you, she's going to find a way to go to the dance with you. I said, sweet. That's all I need to know. So like she's going to move any obstacle if she wants to go to the dance with me. And so she's like, when I ask her, she goes, I can't. I've got to do this and I've got to work and I got to do that. And I'm like, okay, I know what this means. And then something worse happened. For whatever reason, I decide that it's less awkward to knock on a, you know, more or less stranger's door, walk into her room, play her song, ask her out, get rejected, and then go sit down than it would be to walk into her room, play a song, get rejected, and then leave. So I decided to just sit down and blend in at this party that I was not invited to. It's six people, you know, it's not really a party, it's a hangout.
So what you're saying is you would have done it differently.
I know it's a long,
you could do it again.
Yeah, funny story. But yeah, the point is I went big I did not go home. I fell flat on my face, and it would be 2 years because I'm such a wimp. It would be 2 years before I ever did anything so bold for a girl like that ever again. In fact, it would be a long time before I even asked a girl out. And then when I did, it was very safe. And I didn't play a song for a girl until I dated the next girl that I dated, who ended up being my wife. And the differences between those relationships were huge. One was going big, going home, asking somebody, you know, going big or, you know, instead of going home, and focusing so much on the leap without making the plan. And the other one, the woman that I married, I befriended her. I let her know that I liked her, but I spent time getting to know her, figure out what her interests were. I courted her, you know, it's an old school word, but, it was this slow and steady progress towards a goal.
Building bridges.
Yeah. It's not a sexy thing, but it's the way most quote unquote big things in life happen, in my opinion.
It kind of happens without you even realizing that it's happening in a way.
Yeah, well, I think it's intentional, but it's progressive over time. And let's go back to Lane. What could I have done differently there? Well, you know, one key thing I could have done is say more than 5 words to her over the course of a year.
Right.
Like, I met her. She was my orientation leader. I saw her, like, in passing on campus. We did not hang out together. We did not go on any dates. Like, we weren't buddies. I just liked her. I had a crush on her. And so one day I just decided to ask her out. I'm not saying that technique never works, but I am also saying, like, ladies kind of like you to show interest in them and get to know them sometimes. And I would have built a bridge, not take a leap.
And I think that some people maybe are in a situation like that and they never do end up taking the leap in a romantic situation, but that happens with entrepreneurial endeavors and such, where people will, I call it like the fortress fallacy. Like, you imagine this great fortress that you're going to build, but you can't get started on it yet because you have to think through all the parts of the plan, when in fact you could just get started on a little cottage first and you'd be somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, building a bridge is not safe. People die building bridges, you know? It's not a safe thing, but it doesn't happen overnight either. You know, like, it takes time, but you eventually get somewhere that you never could have imagined being. You cross this big chasm. And so I'm just advocating, you know, if you've been thinking it's an all or nothing sort of choice, there's an alternative. You could build a bridge. You could take a 10-year leap, as Ben and Christy Carlson did, and you just might get somewhere that you never imagined being.
Right. I'm going to get into some of the sort of rapid-fire questions.
Okay.
Now that we're running out of time here. What's the biggest compromise that you've had to make to get where you are?
The biggest compromise is spending less time writing than I would like. And I think the reason for that is because I have a family. So whether or not the fount of inspiration is flowing, come 4:30 today, I'm going to pack up and I'm going to head home and spend time with my wife and our 2 kids. And every workaholic bone in my body, which is all of them, like, hurts when I have to do that. Mm-hmm. And yet I know it's really good for me. And, you know, you've heard all these things, like, with kids and with family, you learn how to work faster and smarter and more efficiently. And all those things are true. But I think it's also true that you do less work. You don't get as much time, you know? Like, don't tell me if I had an extra 8 hours at night, you know, like I used to when I was single, that I couldn't get more done. I could. And so having to choose what I'm going to focus my time on and saying no to lots of things so that the time that I do have, I can focus on the work that I want to do, in a way, you know, feels like a compromise. Because if it was just me and my work, I could go, you know, full forge ahead and not worry about the people whose lives I'm impacting. But I love this part in Stephen King's memoir on writing, where he says, I used to think that life was a support system for art, and now I realize that it's the other way around. And I think that's true for any kind of work that you do. Life does not support the work that you do. The work supports the life that you live, and really the two should be integrated with one another.
Yeah, so you're not doing as much work. Do you feel like you're doing better work though because of that
I think so.
concentration?
Yeah, I think so. I just listened to a podcast. It was an episode of Startup where he interviewed Andrew Mason, who
Groupon
founded
founder.
Groupon. Yeah, and I tell this his story, which is an interesting story in The Art of Work, where it started out as a nonprofit organization and turned into this,
The point.
multi-billion-dollar thing because they failed and they had to pivot. And I love that. But he's a dad now, and he's involved in another startup. And he said on this podcast, he said, "Forget what people tell you. When you're a parent, you're worse at your job, like because you don't have as much time. And here's the thing that nobody will say is like you're not as good at your job as you would be if you were just a single, person with all this time to just do better work. At least in his, field of doing, tech startup stuff." I think there's a lot of truth to that. Here's the other part of it though. It's worth it. And I would be so depressed and probably an alcoholic, if I didn't have my family, if I didn't have the life that informs the writing that I do. So yeah, I think I'm a better writer. I think more importantly than that, I'm a more honest writer. I'm a more empathetic writer. I'm a better person, which makes me better at my craft. But could I like technically be a better writer if I had more time doing it? Yeah, maybe. And I think it's important to be honest about the choices that we make in life. Every choice has a cost. There's a choice to leaving my job and becoming a writer. There's a choice to becoming a husband and then a dad. And so every time I make a choice, I try to go, is this going to be worth the cost? And with my family, hands down, it absolutely was.
When's the time that you left money on the table, and what did you get in exchange for that?
Yeah, so this is sort of hitting closer to home. Another compromise that I made, and I ended up thinking it was a really good move. But when I started as a writer, I thought you can't make money writing, so I have to start a business. So I started my blog. I realized that one of the things that got a lot of attention was writing for other writers, helping people the same way I'd been helping them at my day job as a marketing and communications director become better writers, learn how to communicate their ideas better. And so I was like, well, like I'll do that on my blog. Built an audience around that. Started selling an online course around that, and it really provided enough income for me to go write books and not have to worry about how well those books sold. So I didn't have to do this feast or famine thing that a lot of working writers do. So I started a business. This was a compromise, and I realized I actually really enjoyed entrepreneurship and enjoyed running a business a lot. And my ambitious, side where all that ego of wanting to succeed really liked it. And so I got to this point at the end of last year where I, instead of being a writer who had a business to support his writing habit, I was a businessman who wrote sometime when I felt like it, when I had time. And my whole life, my whole work situation had flipped, in something in me, deep in me, said, this is not what we set out to do. Like, this is not right. And so I leave money on the table now every day. I had a conversation with a friend, Sean D'Souza, and he told me he has made the same amount of money every year for the past 8 years. Because once he hits his goal for the year, which is more than enough to live on, he's done and he stops making money. And I was like, huh, that's interesting. I said, so don't you ever worry about like wanting more, like wanting to get better? And, because like this is what we're told, as entrepreneurs, this is what I'm told as an American, I think, like growth equals more. You have to make more money, you've got to do more things. He said, more? No. Better? Yes. He said, I focus not on more, but on doing better work. So I try to get better at my craft every year.
So you've made space to do more writing and less of running the business. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, so I have a team, and we met at the beginning of January. I said, guys, our motto for the year is not more, but better. So if the business grows, great, but we're about quality and we're about craft. And personally, for my calling, I realized that if I'm lying on my deathbed and I was a great entrepreneur and a pretty good writer, I will regret the choices that I made. Whereas if I'm a great writer, or as great of a writer as I can be, and pretty good entrepreneur, I will be proud of that. And so I realized for me, the craft of writing is the most important thing, and I had to make room for that. So yeah, I leave money on the table often because craft of writing is not as lucrative as, you know, selling a $500 online course.
Yeah. What's the last book that you read that changed the way you saw something?
I always forget the books I read. I try to read multiple books in a week. So I read this really great short book by a guy named Rob Bell, who's a spiritual author. It's called How to Be Here. And it talks about your life as a creative act and some, like, what if your life was something that you got to create? And it's an interesting sort of compromise, I think, between like the hardcore, you can plan every aspect of your life, and like the fatalistic, well, life sucks and things happen to you and then you die. Like, you have agency, you have control over how you respond to things like suffering and pain. And it's a really short read. Like, I listened to the audiobook and it was like 3 hours long. So that was good. That got me thinking.
Ties back to the idea of, whether you, when you tell a story about your life and decisions that you made, how much presence of mind you had when you made those decisions.
Is
it something you can create?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And he says we're engaged in the ongoing creation of our lives. And you know, we are, you know, created beings, but we're also creative beings. And so we're making things and we're making our lives because we have choices about where we spend our time and what we do. And maybe those aren't unlimited choices. Maybe you can't be everything that you ever thought you wanted to be. But you have a choice as to, you know, whether or not you get to be this kind of surgeon or that kind of surgeon or, you know, a garbage man or a postal worker. I mean, we have choices, and the choices that we make affect who we become and really the story that we get to tell about our lives.
Do you make your bed?
I don't make my bed. Like, that's the thing now, right? Like, everybody's like, I get up in the morning and I make my bed, and it's like my feng shui. No, I'm messy.
Don't feel too bad about it. I have to let you off the hook. You know, most of the guests in this podcast don't make their bed.
Yeah. Now, you know, I have just recently given myself permission, not to be a slob, but to be okay with some of the things that I'm ashamed about, shortcomings, you know, messiness, you know, struggling with schedule, because I've been doing this really interesting research project for my next book about all of these things that creative people tend to have in common that are not good things, you know, being distracted and, not managing time well and, you know, all these things that sort of fit the starving artist stereotype. And I've realized that these things are shadow sides of something that has, you know, a positive side to it. And there are strengths to it. There are strengths to being distractible. There are strengths to, you know, not really thinking about what time it is and being able to get immersed in the work that you're doing. So it's not to say that I'm not trying to get better and maybe make my bed someday, but I'm like, okay, like this, like the other side of this might be something that makes me really good at what I do. And so I'm becoming a little bit more comfortable with that.
Yeah. And sometimes, and this isn't all the time, but you know, you've got a limited amount of willpower, and if something takes a lot of willpower to do that doesn't come naturally to you, it can perhaps take away your energy for the other things that matter more.
I'm totally snobbish about that. Like, I'll come into my office and it's a mess, and I'm like, well, I could spend 15 minutes of my time cleaning up my office, or I could just get to work. And a lot of times I just get to work because I'm like, well, that 15 minutes could be writing time. And then there are these times where I just go, oh, this is a mess. We've just got to purge this place because it's becoming a distraction. But I agree. Like, you have a limited amount of time. Spend it doing the stuff that only you can do.
And do you have a final message for our listeners who are trying to carve out success by their own definition? Besides, of course, go read The Art of Work.
You know, I was talking to a group of writers last night, and somebody asked me, like, you know, can you still be successful writing online today because it's such a crowded place? I mean, this was a real niche conversation. And something just rose up in me, and I said, I don't know. I mean, I think so. I mean, I see it happen every day, every year. You know, it happens. I don't know if it's easier or harder, but I said, I don't know. Part two of that question is, it doesn't matter. Like, if you have something in you if you don't let that thing out, if you die with the music in you, that's not going to be a happy death. And so I think that we all have a gift to share with the world. I want you to be successful. I hope you're successful. I'd love to guarantee you success. If I could do that, like, your check would be in the mail. And I think that success in many ways is easier and more accessible to the majority of us than it's ever been before because of all kinds of, you know, amazing opportunities that exist in our world today. But I think that's not what you should be thinking about right now. I think you should be thinking about, what is my gift? What's in me? And step one, I think, is sharing that gift. So when I started writing, I thought, yeah, in the back of my head, maybe someday I might be able to make some money off of this. But I was just so tired of not doing it that I realized I just have to do this. I have to put this out there, and I will regret not trying this far more than trying and failing. And so I think that's the question. What is the thing that you will regret not trying, regardless of whether or not you succeed? And I think you at least owe it to yourself and to the world to try it.
And to circle back to what we were talking about with willpower being a limited resource, there's some things where just resisting actually doing the thing is such a use of your mental energy.
It is, yeah.
That you're better off if you just carve out some time to go ahead and do it instead of trying to resist.
Yeah, that's well said.
And where can people find more of you?
Well, thanks for doing this, David. This was great. You can find me at my blog, my website at Goinswriter, GOINSWriter.com. If you're interested in the art of work, you can go to that URL and sign up for my free weekly email newsletter, and you'll get the first two chapters for free, and you can check it out. Again, that's Goinswriter.com.
Great. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Jeff.
Thanks. It's my pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Jeff Goins. Remember, if you pick up his book, The Art of Work, at kadavy.net/artofwork, you will be supporting the show. And if you enjoyed that conversation, you should listen to the episode with Jody Ettenberg of Legal Nomads. That's episode 23. Notice how Jody listened to her life. She quit her job as a lawyer and somehow managed to spend the past 8 years traveling while writing about her favorite foods. It's really an amazing story. And before I go, I've got to ask, do you like books? If you do, I'd love to send you my book recommendations. About 90% of them will be nonfiction on subjects spanning from biographies to neuroscience. Just go to kadavy.net/reading, sign up, and you'll get my first set of book recommendations right away. You'll be supporting the show if you buy any of those books through the links in the email. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Kadavy. The theme music for the show is See In You, performed by The Album Leaf, courtesy of Sub Pop Records. Love Your Work is a production of Kadavy, Inc.